So we had been considering various aspects of the mitzvah of Simchas Farsim V'Kala. So last week we talked about a couple questions about what is it exactly that makes the mitzvah necessary, why is this considered a chesed, it should be something that is less needed than every other chesed is about taking somebody who's sad and making them happy. Here we find things going seemingly from a different place, and we talked a little bit about what that could mean, and a little bit about different hashgachic theories about what's involved, and a little bit about the question of what does it mean when we're shooting for an attendance at the wedding, what kind of attendance, which also tied back into the question of what really is the mitzvah meant to accomplish. And I think the last point we had left off with was the possibility of a difference here between the mitzvah of Simchas Chasen and Kala, and the concept of Hachnasas Kala, where we saw we had some ambiguity. Are those meant to be interchangeable terms? Do they mean the same thing? It's just a different word. Or, and again, they're both brought in the same halacha together there in the very beginning of Siman Samachay. Or do they have different components to there? So let's try to theorize about that, Mom. So what would the mitzvah of Hachnasas Kala specifically be about? What would the idea be if we have a focus specifically on the Kala and the word Hachnasa? So does that suggest any possible theory about what we're trying to accomplish? Any ideas, Itzi?
Maybe the chiyuv that the husband has on his wife. Okay.
Seems to be evocative of that to some extent, right? But then the question is, what has that got to do with everyone else who's there? Now, to a certain extent, it's true that we did see, and we discussed a little bit last week, the idea that the mitzvah of Simchas Chasen and Kala does also include a particular focus on the Chasen. And that we found in the first parak, the idea of shoktu, that Chazal Meir Takana, that the husband should really exert himself to properly appreciate his kala as evidenced through the effort he makes to set up the suda. So there is some aspect of that, but we have to figure out exactly how that really translates to everybody else. So here in our sugi, we are clearly talking about a mitzvah that certainly includes, at least prominently, all the other people. So they don't have chiyuvim towards the wife in the way the husband does. So what is their chiyuv? What's the idea there? And let's assume again that this is still a component of chesed. This is still within the broad rubric of chesed. So what's the nature of the chesed?
Are you mentioned last week, I think, by making this whole to-do, it brings it around the responsibility of the wedding.
Emphasizes the responsibility, right?
So I thought maybe that would be the emphasis of the attendance and everyone there makes it more
of a real thing. Like the chassan can't say, "Listen, this is some kind of a casual relationship that I can ignore, that doesn't really impose a lot of responsibilities on me. I just had 500 people come and watch me do this." So it's interesting, you know. Again, when we think about the sukkah that way, so its place here is even more appropriate, that it's placed specifically here. It's really, you know, it's a good question how much attention to be put on where a sugi appears and where it doesn't appear. But its placement here is something which is worth noting. On the one hand, we saw that this parak does emphasize the fact that there was a certain environment in which you would know about the wedding taking place, the kala being absolved with that whole story. So from that perspective, the sugya coming here makes sense. But maybe specifically as a ksubis sugya, as opposed to a kedushin sugya. So we mentioned that the Shulchan Aruch, which again, we have to figure out if we pay as much attention to the placement of the Shulchan Aruch as we do within the Rambam. The Rambam is famous for very precise placement. But the idea that it's the bridge halacha between Hilchos Kedushin and Hilchos Ksubis is maybe significant, but the placement here in the sugi of Maseches Ksubis, maybe it's all part of a Ksuba mentality. This is not just celebrating the Maisa Kedushin, this is emphasizing the Chiyuvim of the Baal Ishto and the complete picture of appreciation that the marriage is meant to convey, and the idea of seriousness that's supposed to accompany this whole story. So maybe the placement here, Davka, in this Masechta, has that resonance as well. You know, it's interesting. So there is a question you could ask. So how much of a importance is placed on the reading of the ksuba at the wedding? And the idea that the ksuba is read, how important is that? So what would happen if you didn't have the ksuba read at all? And if you want to really be love the Shabbat, you're giving out kibbutim. So you want to really figure out what kavod means what kibbutim represents, what idea and how to rank them. So it becomes a little bit of a question to try to figure out. So what exactly is the role of the reading the ksuba? Why do we have the ksuba read at the wedding? So right, so that's what Rav Shechter often says, right? So the one approach that Rav Shechter points out very often is that we have two brachos, baruch pei hagafen, being recited under the chuppah. So we have the first one from the Berachas Eirusin, and then it comes up again as part of the Sheva brachos. So it's a shiloh, what justifies that? Now, without getting into the whole question of what justifies the one making that bracha to do so in the first place, if he's not the one drinking. They'll say the rabbi makes the first one, and whoever gets the first of the Sheva brachos is making the second one. So what justifies them making the bracha in the first place? It's generally not them drinking. So maybe we'll get to that sugya a little bit later. We're going to discuss in the first pair of sugyas maybe a little bit later on in the year. But as it is, it's already a question how you can make one baruch pei hagafen if the person who's making it is not the one drinking it. But why do we have two? Why is it to have two baruch pei hagafens in such quick succession? Seems to be a problem. Once upon a time, where they had kiddushin separate from the nisuin, so okay, it could be several months apart. So fine, you need to bury for your documents, but to have two a few minutes apart seems to raise issues. So as Rav Shechter often notes, that we want to create whatever delay we can in between those two. It's not going to be much of a delay. We have a very contracted time period here, but whatever we can put in between those two bury for your documents, so we put them in. So, as he knows, if the rabbi is doing a midrasha, so that would be a good time to do a midrasha. That's the ideal time to stall a little bit in between the two baruch pei hagafens. And the reading of the ksuba is going to fit in that slot as well. So, if that's the case, so then there really isn't much of an emphasis on who reads the ksuba. Right? The ksuba really could be read by anybody if it's really just there to stall. They can say, all right, so let's stall. So then let's I'll show a movie in the middle. What exactly is the point of reading the ksuba dafka if you saw it with anything? So that's itself a question. So does it really matter what we're doing at that point? Presumably we don't want to really do something which would take everyone's mind out of the event. We want to do something somewhat relevant, so I guess ksuba is as good a candidate as possible. But theoretically, if that's the whole story, so then it would seem theoretically that you could read anything or you could have anyone read it. Guess you had a point about that?
Isn't the whole meal eaten in between that time?
No. No, you think the second, another baruch pei hagafen is the third baruch pei hagafen.
I thought you said that the first bracha of the Sheva brachos is one baruch pei hagafen, and
the fifth bracha, that's the second one.
That's the second one.
Over the course of the night, there's three baruch pei hagafens. That two are under the chuppah.
Right, but isn't the first bracha of the Sheva brachos after benching?
That's the second time it happens. Now, we recite Sheva brachos usually twice the wedding night. So there is the recitation under the chuppah, and there's the recitation at the end of the meal. And actually, baruch pei hagafen shifts as to what number it is among the seven in that process. So we do it at the meal also, then okay, fine, that's several hours later. But under the chuppah, we also make it twice for Berachas Eirusin and for Sheva brachos. So if the whole point is to stall a little bit, okay, so then it wouldn't seem to matter so much. Heard also from Reb Lachman Karabiavna that the idea, he had a different understanding of different tradition about what the reading of the ksuba was meant to accomplish, that the idea is that we want to scare the chassan a little bit, that we want to make it clear that he should know what his responsibilities are, that he shouldn't take it lightly, so it's not just that he committed himself to the ksuba, but there should be a public reading of this declaration. So this should all go towards emphasizing the importance. And to that end, so he noted that the idea that it shouldn't be anybody, but it should be somebody
of stature should be, let's say, the town rabbi who represents the rabbinic authority should be getting up there, essentially, with the reading of the super constitutes, is the rabbi is getting up there and saying, everyone, listen, this man has accepted upon himself these chiyuvim, and all of us are here to witness this, not just in the technical sense, but in the practical sense, we're all here to see that this obligation has been undertaken. So in that sense, there are aspects of this ceremony which, like Aryeh is saying, is really there to make this point. So, to a certain extent, that's probably true. There seems to be other aspects of Hachnasas Kavod as well. And again, to focus from the Chesed component. So, it seems also that there is, so we discussed in terms of Simchas Chasen and Kavod, we want to make sure they have confidence in their decision that their anxiety is come. But there is a unique anxiety that's relevant to the Kala, right? Especially in a traditional model where the Kala is going from her father's household to her husband's household. So it's a big disorientation. It's a big dislocation. So you're coming from one context in which you've grown up your whole life and you're accustomed to. And now you're shifting into a whole different setting. So that's not easy. You need to be oriented. You need to have an accompaniment, so to speak, to be brought into that context. So the idea of Hachnasas Kala is very much in sync with that. Look at the words, right? You are bringing in the Kala. So the idea is the Kala is being brought into a new household. And that process of bringing her in should be made joyous, should be made easy, should be emphasized in a positive sense. Everything that accompanies that is meant to be a part of it. So you see, for example, Rashi, when he talks about, let's say, Rashi and Ardaf, for example, the Rashi about Mavirin, right, the idea that we give priority to the Kala, even when the mace is passing. So Rashi writes, Dibur Maskel Mavirin, Kishakala Yotza V'beis Avia L'beis Chasunasa. So there you get the impression that basically what's happening, that the idea of Hachnasas Kala is that she doesn't just kind of catch a ride on her own to the wedding, on the wedding day, and call a taxi and go to the chuppah, but that there is an accompaniment that goes from her father's house all the way to the chuppah itself. And so if that's the idea, that there's meant to be accompaniment throughout that whole process, so for example, Laprisha says on the side of the Torah, that, so what happens nowadays? So nowadays we are derelict. We're lax. Do you ever see that happen? Do you ever go to a wedding where you see we show up first at the Kala's house and then dance her all the way from her house to the hall? Probably how many have ever seen a wedding like that? Right, so you might say, well, nowadays the Kala comes from this city and the Chasa comes from that city and the wedding is in a different city. So how often is it really going to be feasible? Very expensive plane tickets maybe to have that happen. Although it's interesting, though, if the minig is more often that the wedding takes place in the hometown of the Kala, it tends to be the more prevalent minig. So there are various other reasons for that, but theoretically it makes it a little more likely, okay, you can go to her father's house and accompany her to the place of the chuppah. So the Prisha said, so we're missing something nowadays. He apparently in his day also, he didn't see that happen at too many weddings, and he says that seems to be from the Rishonim what the mitzvah is supposed to be. So the Taz writes, if you see this Taz, I can put it on the Maamar Kamos, right? The Taz, okay, maybe not, but the Taz says, no, we're not so terrible, we're bad at other things, we're not so bad at this, that this does happen, that it doesn't mean that everyone should accompany her. It means that the women should accompany her, that she should be accompanied by her family members, by her female family members. She shouldn't go alone. So it generally is the case that she is accompanied from that stage, at least by somebody. And at that point, at the earlier stage, you can't expect everyone to come. You're not going to want all the men and the women to mingle over there. It's not going to be so appropriate. So overall, there's a gathering of everybody at the wedding. But this beginning process, so indeed, she doesn't go alone. She's accompanied by her family members and by the female family members. And that's appropriate. That's a part of what's meant to happen. And the Shlomo writes, in general, that this is something which is variable based on the time and the context, that it doesn't have to have the exact same model in every era. What is the minig as far as making her comfortable and making her feel like she is being acclimated into the context? And it could shift from one generation to the next. And it also means it doesn't just refer to physically accompanying her from one household to the other, but everything that makes that process smoother and that makes that process more joyous is also a part of the mitzvah. So we're discussing last week that Kiva was mentioning that you ask, what does Hafnachtas Kala mean? So you often hear it in the context of a tzedakah pitch, right? Somebody comes to raise money and says, Hafnachtas Kala. So is that a misnomer? What does that have to do with anything? So presumably not. It's not a misnomer that also helping with the expenses of the wedding itself, but also the marriage, to make sure that the couple can get married, and that's expensive, so sometimes that's what is necessary. It's clear that that's a bigger priority as far as stuff is concerned, right? That the family should be able to have a life together if they can't afford to do that. So that is certainly a stucca goal, but that the wedding itself should happen. Wedding also, as you know, costs a lot of money, so that's also within the priorities of tzedakah, because all of that contributes to this goal of hachnasas kala, of bringing the kala in a way that allows her to feel joy and to feel comforted at the disorientation that is taking place. Okay, so this is variable, not only in terms of what the mitzvah means, but presumably also in terms of what does the process of the mitzvah mean, you know, in terms of who does it apply to and what does it involve. So different individuals are going to also have a different responsibility, right? So that somebody who's closer to the family, closer to the kala, closer to the chasen, is going to have a greater chiyuv on them. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a famous tshuva where he talks about how somebody's holding the sfira during the machlokas times of shir, they would normally be going to joyous events during that time, but is invited to a wedding by somebody who's not holding the sfira then, so then it's justified and required for him to put aside his sfira practices in order to attend the wedding because of the obligation that he has as somebody who is close to the principal participants. And in addition to that, so we also find a somewhat sliding scale of what does it mean to be there? What does it mean to do? And who has to be there in the first place? And what do they have to do? The Chazon Ish commented that this is also a question of a minig and a question of whatever the convention is, that in different contexts, so you have different people with different expectations, and that also is going to define the chiyuv. So the chiyuv in one generation might be different than the chiyuv in a different generation if the expectations are different. And as an example of how it shifts for individuals, so Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was quoted as saying that he had kind of a trade-off, that when he was a younger, he was a yeshiva student, so he didn't go to so many weddings, and he was learning Yom Balayla, but the trade-off is that he became Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and so when he was older, and he was invited to weddings, so when he would show up at a wedding, it was because of his reputation, it would have a greater impact on the simcha of the event than it would have had otherwise. So he suggested that it all was kind of a trade-off, which had different benefits in terms of the sliding scale, that it's a different expectation on different people. So for some people, being there the whole time will be the mitzvah, and for some people, being there at all is going to give a certain amount of stature to the event, and by doing so, is going to create simcha in its own sense. It's important to realize that when you're dealing with things like this, that it's not always about what's reasonable. That doesn't mean that you can be expected to do things that aren't reasonable for you to do, but when you're trying to evaluate to what extent your presence will contribute and will give simcha to the chasen kala, or conversely, your absence will have a big effect on the chasen and kala in a negative sense. So you might think, well, you know, it's not so reasonable for them to be upset if I'm not there. So it's not totally about what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. That there is a Gemara in Masechet Sukkos, and on Masechta, and of Samach Zayin, where the Gemara talks about De Machsoro. Right? So the Gemara says that there's an obligation, the Torah says in Parashas Re'eh, that if somebody needs Taka, so we're obligated to help them out. And so the question could come up, so how much are you obligated to do? So says the Torah, De Machsoro, whatever they're missing. So Gemara gives a very extreme example. Gemara says, let's say somebody was so wealthy, so he used to have servants who would run in front of him when he would go in the street. So then it becomes a tzedakah goal, not necessarily the highest priority, but it becomes within the goal of tzedakah to give funds towards that, towards getting servants to run in front of him. So it's interesting if you think about that. What's the chiddush of that gemara? Or what's the main point of that gemara?
It's not just about regular how much they need to eat or live. It's getting them back to a stature that they were used to beforehand.
And that's definitely a part of it, but there's an added nature specifically focusing on these avodim running in front of him. So that's probably part of it also. I would emphasize the word feel, right? That it's not just about, say, a standard of living, but if somebody has a certain emotional need, that's also a part of De Machzor. So there were those who commented on that Gemara. It seems pretty ridiculous. Now you could say, alright, there are people who like luxuries, right? So somebody who used to have a big swimming pool or a very comfortable house or a car that was a fancy car. So you could talk about, fine, is that De Machzor? Is that something that we should include in Saka, or should we say it's only absolute necessities? But this idea of having a Avadim run in front of you in the street, it seems kind of nuts, right? Is that something that any normal person really needs or really even benefits from? Yeah, needs, but really benefits from? So there are some who commented on this that it shows that even, as we say, a mishigas could also be a part of De Machzor. If somebody has an emotional need for something, it doesn't matter that it's not a real benefit or even a real luxury, but it's something the person feels is necessary, so that's also part of De Machzor. So here, we're not really dealing with mishigas, we're dealing with the average normal emotional needs people have to be able to share their moments of joy and their moments of sorrow. So whether or not you totally understand it, it's possible that if the sense is that it's very important to a person that you be there, that could create a chiyuv in the sense of de machzor. It doesn't mean that you can do what you can't do. So if it's impossible, it's going to be such a burden on your time or your finances or whatever it's involved to get there. If it's not reasonable, it's not a reasonable expectation of you, it's still not going to be a reasonable expectation. But when I say it doesn't have to be reasonable, it means that your understanding of why they want it is not necessarily a priority. If it's important to the person that you should be there, so then that has halachic significance, even if it's not, even if you're not necessarily machshir the relationship so much, even if you wouldn't think you would think that, as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy to get married in a small room with 10 people there, I wouldn't need this. We were chavrus together 10 years ago for summer, night seder, barely knew each other, it wouldn't be so important to me. So that's not necessarily the standard. If it's important to them, presumably it's together de machzor. That being the case, though, so if you don't have an overt sense that that's the case, so then presumably it does function on a reciprocity type of standard, that if you would want somebody at your wedding and you would feel that that would be beneficial to you, so then to try to be there for them presumably is a good rule of thumb as to when it makes sense. They point out this far, and there's a Gemara in the end of Masechet Sukkah, which suggests this is Midas HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where the Gemara is over there in the Sukkah, talk about Simchat Beis HaShoeva and rejoicing on Sukkot in God's presence. So the Gemara there says they used to sing then, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you come to my house and you dance, you come to my Simcha, so to speak, I'll be at your Simcha. So it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself says this, you come to my events, I'll come to your events. And that is a mentality which, on some level, makes sense. It's interesting, inverse of that. We won't get into this right now, but just to be aware of it, there actually is a discussion that what if somebody says, okay, I'm not going to come to his chasana because he didn't come to my chasana. So, or I'm not going to invite him to my chasana because he didn't invite me to his chasana. So the poskim actually discuss, is that an issue? It could be another problem. What would that be? It might be losikum velosito. Maybe that's called taking revenge. So there's an interesting discussion. We won't really get into it now because that is a tangent. But there is a discussion. So what if you make that decision? But what if it's purely economic? You say, listen, I have to decide who to spend money on, who to invite as guests. So I'll assume that if they invited me to their wedding, so then, okay, they're matching the relationship enough that I should invite them to my wedding and it's worth spending the money on. But if not, then from an economic cheshbon, it's not worth it. So is that called losiko losito? Very likely not. But if the motive is more emotional, well, he didn't invite me, I'm not going to invite him, or he didn't come to my son, I'm not going to come to his. So then the post can discuss, is that possibly a violation of the isur notarah losikom losito? So that's the whole different aspect. But from a positive perspective, what is the mitzvah of Simchas Chasan and Kala demand? So it's possible to say that, strictly speaking, this might be a good rule of thumb. But again, that's going to vary if you feel there is an emotional need on the part of the other party, even if you don't necessarily share it, you wouldn't have felt the same in the other direction. And also it's going to vary for personality. So Shlomo Zalman's point, that he felt that he contributed by going to chasanas, so presumably those chasanas were not necessarily cases where he would have expected all those chasanas to be at his wedding. It's not necessarily a relevant cheshbon in that case to go in both directions. So it's going to vary on an individual basis. So once we try to figure out who it is who comes to the wedding in the first place, so what is the obligation? What does it mean to be mesameach once you're there? What's considered to be the fulfillment of the mitzvah? Especially if you recall that we mentioned last week the Gemara in Maseches Brachos, which says that kol hanena misudas chasin v'eino mesamcho is over mishum hey kolos, that it's possible for a person to be subject to even greater criticism than not showing up in the first place if he comes to the wedding is not mesameach. So it sounds like the mitzvah is not just being there, but the mitzvah is something more. So what does the mitzvah entail? So what do we know from our Gemara that it seems to entail? Right, what does our Gemara mention? What does our Gemara start off focusing on?
Dancing,
right? So dancing clearly has a big role. The language is interesting, right? So what does the word actually mean? Ketzad miraktim lifnei hakala. But then the Gemara goes on not to tell you dance tips, right? What does the Gemara say in the context of Ketzad miraktim? What's the next line that we spent some time talking about? Right, what's Rashi say, right? Ma omrim lefaneha. So what does omrim have to do with miraktim? Right, why doesn't Rashi say that you do the horo, you do whatever it is, I don't know the name of any of the dances, but whatever the name might be, why doesn't Rashi tell you what steps to do? So what's Pshat? What's the relationship of Omrim to dancing?
Apparently, that's what they would do when they would dance. They would say a song.
So you say that's a type of dancing. Dancing is something that happens with words, and therefore that's how you dance. Could be.
Maybe it could just be that dancing is how some people express their simcha, and if you use words, if you don't want to.
Oh, so maybe that means it's an alternative route, that maybe the Gemara is using miraktim as a kind of a code word for general mesameach chasan kala, but really it doesn't mean it, which is a very interesting possibility. That maybe the same way we're using words like simchas chasan kala and hachnasa possibly interchangeably, maybe miraktim is another synonym. It doesn't actually mean dance, it means that's the word that we hold on to because it's the most visible thing. But it's a way of saying maybe Ketzad miraktim lifnei hakala should be read as how do we celebrate at a wedding? And then the Gemara shifts to actually giving an example of a different kind of celebration. Maybe it doesn't include dancing at all. Right? Maybe it means that you get up and you give a speech and you say, Kalanah v'chasuda. That's what the fulfillment is. But some will point out that maybe if you wanted to say dancing, it should be Ketzad roped in. And that miraktim has the connotation of making others dance. And that maybe this is the way you get up and you say, Kalanala v'chazuga, and that gets other people to dance in front of the Kala. Maybe that's what it means when we focus on kids upper act. So that itself is interesting. Just parenthetically, trying to figure out this question. So it has a halachic nafkamina in a different sense. That on the one hand, so we want to figure out how to do the mitzvah because this is a mitzvah we want to do it the best way possible. Right, so we want to know that if we have a mitzvah to be mesameach chasan kala, so we want to get some sense of what that entails so that we can do the best job, especially also because the Gemara we just quoted says that theoretically you get in trouble for not being mesameach, so you don't want to fall short and be subject to that kind of criticism. But it has another halachic nafkamina also that Post can talk about, that when it comes to Sheva Brachas throughout the week, so there is a requirement, a fascinating requirement of Sheva Brachos called Panim Chadashos. Right, what does that mean? It means that in order to make Sheva Brachos, in order to recite the Brachos throughout the week after the wedding, so it's necessary that present at this gathering there be a Tosefet Simcha, that there be some additional rejoicing. That happens because there are additional guests. There are people there who were not present at the initial wedding. So sometimes in smaller social circles, it's not so easy, right? You're trying to set up a week of parties after the wedding. So some people have a million friends and they can't invite everyone to the wedding in the first place. So sometimes and they have many different social circles and many different worlds that they occupy. So the Sheva Brachos is an opportunity to extend the celebration to people who weren't able to be invited to the wedding. Sometimes the Sheva Brachos actually take place in different cities. So if that's the case, Taka, we understand it. Taka, that's the idea, that you have really a whole different celebration that's new. It's not the wedding celebration, it's in celebration of the wedding, but it's a new celebration of the wedding. So it justifies a new set of brachos. But sometimes it's a lot harder. Sometimes people don't have a million different people to invite, and you want to have a Sheva Brachos, but the people who are involved are all people who were at the wedding. So then what exactly is the standard? So for example, it's possible some Rishonim note that Shabbos may justify its own Sheva Brachos, even if everybody present at a Shabbos meal was at the wedding. Maybe Shabbos itself is considered to be Panim Chadashos. God willing, maybe later in the year we'll come back to Sugya of Sheva Brachos and Panim Chadashos. But one of the issues the post can consider is, so let's say somebody was at the wedding, but he stopped in for a minute. He wasn't at the meal, he didn't dance. He came in, let's say he was there in a technical role, he was the photographer. Let's say he came by mistake, but it was a different person's wedding. So at what point do we say you were there so much that you can't justify another Sheva Brachos? And at what point do we say that even if you were there, maybe that's still not considered to have celebrated already, and you can justify a new Sheva Brachos? That's an extra halachic nafkamina. Not only do we want to know how to properly fulfill this mitzvah and to avoid criticism for not fulfilling the mitzvah, but we also want to know that does the person qualify in order to justify another set of Sheva Brachos later in the week? So it's relevant as far as that's concerned. So we find dancing to be a part of it. It could be that there are other components as well. So what about, for example, let's say if somebody's going to give a speech. Let's say somebody's going to give a Dvar Torah at the wedding. So is that a fulfillment of Simchas Chasan Kala? So presumably it is a fulfillment. And it's interesting, there is a Gemara which suggests, different from our Gemara, but I think it was on our Gemara from last week, if I remember correctly. There's a Gemara that suggests that maybe that is even more a core fulfillment than Kate Samarakdin. What Gemara am I talking about? I remember it's a Gemara also in Brachos and Davav, but different from this passage of Kol Nenem Yisus Chasim Veinu Masamcho. There's another Gemara over there, right in the same neighborhood. It's a fascinating Gemara in general. The Gemara has a list of all the Agras. And the Gemara says, Agra did this, that, Agra did that, this. that the reward, that the schar that you get for a mitzvah is X. This mitzvah is X, and that mitzvah is Y, etc., etc. So, it doesn't tell you what the reward is in the sense of dollars and cents. It means that whatever the schar you get in Shemayim for a mitzvah is assessed based on a certain factor. So for every mitzvah, it's a different factor. So there's a lot of fascinating things you could derive from that Gemara. We spend a long time talking about the different parts of that Gemara, but we'll just focus on the one that's relevant to our sugya. So what does the Gemara say about a wedding? Remember? It's one of our Komos. The Gemara says, Agra debe yivulei miwe. Right? That the reward for going to a chasana is the words. So that, you know, really puts a whole different focus on our Gemara. If you look at our Gemara, so at least the beginning of our Gemara, you see, okay, what's the ikar? What's the main verb of Simchas Chasana Kala? What's the main action item? Sounds like Meraktan. But if you look in the Gemara Brachos, it says, if you could pick one thing that's going to identify what it is, it would be words. So words could mean things like Divrei Torah. Right, Divrei Torah, we certainly believe, are identified with Simcha. Right, how do we know that Simcha is identical to Torah? From a halachic perspective, in a different area of life? Well, the Gemara is Torah. Well, okay, the words of Torah. Right, so the Gemara at the end of Masechet Tainis tells us that there is a prohibition in Talmud Torah during Avelus, the prohibition of Talmud Torah on Tisha B'Av. The Gemara quotes a pasuk, Pekudei Hashem Yisharim Misam Chelev. They believe that there is a essence, a Torah that is itself Simcha. The Eglital has the famous Hakdama. The Eglital is the author of the Avnei Nezer. We learn Shabbos, so we talk about him all the time. But the Avnei Nezer, Sefer Shavu Rebbe, the Sefer on Shabbos, which is itself a very important Sefer, a very, very important Sefer. But in Hakdama is equally famous, not just about Shabbos issues. So in the introduction to the Eglei Tal, so he discusses a question he got. No one's got this question, at least once sincerely, from somebody asking the question himself. So sometimes people ask that they feel that their learning is not really Lishma. That we're supposed to learn part of Lishma, and sometimes people feel their learning is not Lishma. Why? Because they enjoy it too much. They get such a geschmack out of learning, they feel like they're learning because it's enjoyable, they're not learning for the mitzvah. So the Eglei Tal said, no, chas v'shalom. That's not called not lishma. That is lishma. That the happiest thing you can do is to really understand the sukkah, really understand the chachma sabari. That's itself the fulfillment of simcha in its purest sense. So to say that's not lishma, I'd say quite the opposite. Somebody who really feels geshmak in his learning, so that is the lishma in the most absolute sense. And to you say, I would say the opposite, that if somebody told me that I'm learning, but I'm miserable, I hate it, but at least I'm fulfilling the mitzvah, so says the Eglei Tal, say, then maybe you have a problem. That's really, if you're not enjoying it, but to say that you're enjoying it and that it's not lishma because you're enjoying it, quite the opposite. So Torah equals simcha. And Rav Schechter often quotes from Rav Soloveitchik that the idea that we have that a Baal Simcha has a priority for an Aliyah. So what's the idea that just because somebody has a chasen, somebody's making a bris, bar mitzvah, so we give somebody an Aliyah just because they're a Baal Simcha? So the Rav understood that part of the whole chesed notion, somebody who has a simcha going on, so he wants to share that simcha with others. That's also the other direction of the chesed. He wants to give the simcha to other people. So an aliyah is a form of public Talmud Torah. And that the idea is just as the Baal Simcha wants to share his simcha with everyone around him, so by teaching Torah, once upon a time a person got aliyah with Ling, right? That's really what the Ola is doing symbolically. So the Ola is teaching Torah to Rabbi, and that's a form of an expression of simcha. So you could say that if you give a Dvar Torah at the wedding, so then that's also an expression of simcha. And that's a fulfillment of Chasan Kala.
have Simchas Chasen Kal. Now, of course, there aren't going to be so many slots. It's not going to be so easy for everyone, even if you have Talmidei Chachamim, but usually not all Talmidei Chachamim are going to get to speak. Nowadays, you see Divrei Torah at weddings less, which I think is a little bit unfortunate. And, it's kind of going out of fashion a little bit to have the Divrei Torah by the chuppah, the Divrei Torah by the meal. But it's a chaval, because there is a role for Divrei Torah in a couple senses of the word. So to have nobody saying any Divrei Torah throughout the evening is particularly a chaval. Again, it certainly seems to be the more popular approach nowadays, but it's a shtickle of shame. So you find, classically, that maybe you can make a case that everybody who's able to should be sharing the Divrei Torah at the wedding. So clearly that's not feasible. But if somebody is in a position to give Divrei Torah, so then that's going to be a fulfillment of Simchas Chasen Kala as well. So it could be that's what it means when it says Agra Debei Hilula Mile. But it could be something else. So the Radak, in his commentary to Tehillim, the Radak says that the reason, you could ask the question, why do we even use this word? Forget about it. We focus on what the source of the Agra is, the Mile. You could ask the question on the word itself. Why is the wedding all of a sudden called the Behi Lue? Did everyone say, anyone ever asked you, can you give me a ride to the Behi Lue? Right, so where do we get this phrase? That's Mara General, a fascinating Gemara. He spent really a lot of time analyzing every correlation the Gemara has there, the language the Gemara uses in the correlation. There's really a lot to say about that Gemara. We're just focusing on the one phrase that's relevant to us here. But the phrase itself, Behilule, is not the usual word that we use. The Radak says it's called Behilule Shemahalulim Boasakalo. Right, that we praise the Kala. So if that's the case, so then it suggests again that maybe it's not necessarily that the Divrei Torah, and the Divrei Torah are great also, the Divrei Torah are very much offense, the Divrei Torah certainly have a place, but it could be that the real focus here when we talk about words is words that praise the Kala, and in which case, again, that puts everything back into a certain context, that maybe this whole mitzvah of Simchas Chasen Kala and Hachnasas Chasen Kala is all about making the chasen appreciate the kala more, making the couple feel like they're getting a great deal, and therefore, again, so our Gemara, when it talks about Meraktim, so Meraktim presumably is a vehicle towards that end, and especially if we talk about with Rashi, and then what the Gemara actually brings up as the Meraktim ideal of Kalandah B'chasudah, so it seems like it's really about what you say, what you do to create this mentality that there is a tremendous simcha here and that there is a great source of bracha for the chasen and the kala to appreciate each other. Okay, so with that in mind, so the post can discuss also. So, for example, the Chavos Yar has the famous tshuva, Siman Reishei, where he writes that a Talmud Chacham shouldn't feel that if he's going to dance in front of the Kala. So he might think, okay, Talmud Chacham behemoth yichvodo, that this isn't really in keeping with his honor. So as the Chavos Yar notes, that itself is a mitzvah, and therefore it's appropriate for the Talmud Chacham to do this. Doesn't mean that everything's appropriate, that there's still actions which inherently may raise a question of whether they're appropriate or not, per se, but the idea that engaging in the basics of what the Gemara describes here, and then to see in our daf there are some examples that are a little bit more extreme, which itself is worthy of its own analysis, but to say that this is not the l'fichvodo, so that doesn't seem to be the case. It seems to be that that's all a part of the mitzvah that emerges in this chasen kala context. So with that, so now in terms of our Gemara focusing specifically on the relationship between this and the Levayas HaMeis, so now we have to figure out for a few minutes, this probably will
spill over a little bit into tomorrow, but hopefully we'll be able to wrap it up at the beginning of tomorrow. So our Gemara now emphasizes that on the one hand there is a shared chiyuv, right, that we find that both by the Levaya and by the Kala, so we have some shared concepts, we also have some contrasted concepts. Right, on the one hand, so there is an obligation of attendance at both, so we find that both of them have this din of Mevatlin Talmud Torah. Right, we have to figure out exactly how do we balance that, right? What the chiddush is really in both cases. So they say Mevatlin Talmud Torah. So first of all, what does that mean? Is that a chiyuv or is that a rishus? Right. So if you saw it today on the new list, right? So what do the rishonim say here? Machlokes. Right. It's machlokes. Right. Of course, it was a safe answer. Right. How would you say the majority lies? The question is, with this statement of Mevatlin, let's say, Hotzah Sameis, or Achnas Kala, so the standard of Mevatlin Torah, is that a Chiyuv or is that a Rishus?
It's Rishus to take care of, but a Chiyuv to go.
Rishus to take care of,
but
a Chiyuv to go.
So
what does that mean?
It's Rishus to make sure that the mace is taken care of, but it's a Chiyuv then to actually go to the escorting.
Interesting, I would probably think actually it's the opposite, if anything. Right, that if that distinction is true, we'll get to this more a little bit tomorrow, but if that distinction is true, so it probably goes in the opposite direction, that it's probably that the chiyuv, to make sure it's taken care of, that is the chiyuv, because that's really do or die, that's really an absolute necessity that somebody takes care of it. So whether you have to be the one to take care of it yourself or not, that's a little bit of a question, but to make sure it's taken care of, that would seem to be the chiyuv. Then you could say, all right, if it's taken care of, then should I also be there? So maybe that's subject to rishus. So it seems like if you have a focus about whether this din is a rishus at all, or a chiyuv at all, or a rishus. And the striking thing is that the majority of Rishonim probably maintain that it's actually a chiyuv. It's a chiyuv to be mevatel Torah for this purpose. So the question is, does that really correspond to our contemporary reality? So nowadays we see that every time there's a wedding and every time there's a funeral, that we lock the doors to the Beis Medrash and we say, sorry, no one's allowed to be here because everyone's mechuyev to be mevatel Torah. So you don't usually find that, and it's a question, why not? And we'll focus a little bit more on that tomorrow. Sorry, hi.
To the answer to that question, do you...
That what that he wants to take care of?
Like, reason we don't lock it up is because the chiyuv is that it's taken care of, and not everyone needs to take care of it.
So in the case of Havaya Sameis, you know, if you will go into more details, there are some who suggest that Bisman has that. So we have Chevra Kedisha. So the Chevra Kedisha acts as the representatives of the tzibur. So that's essentially what gets us off the hook. That basically we're saying that everyone has to go means everyone has to take care of it, and in order to make sure it gets taken care of, so we have to tell everyone to go and to do it. But if you have a standing committee, you have a Chevra Kedisha in the city, so then that means that the city is represented by them, and then it's not such a chiyuv to go. So if that's true, that might work for Levaya, it won't necessarily work for the Achnasas Klas Mikala. I don't know if anyone has a standing wedding going to committee. There are people who focus very much. You know, I have a friend who considered it an obligation to learn how to juggle as a Hechsher Mitzvah, because now he goes to weddings and he juggles very dramatically, and that was his. That was one of the things. He does many mitzvahs, but that was one of the things that he did as. In order to expand his ability to fulfill this mitzvah, in order to be able to be more capable in the mitzvah of Simchas Kos Mikala. So we do have people who, I guess, focus, but it's not the same way. So one question is whether or not there is any parallel within Hachnasas Kos Mikala to the Chevra Kedisha. The other problem with putting it all on the Chevra Kedisha is, and this is something we'll have to say a little bit more about tomorrow, is that it's assuming that the whole mitzvah is the kvura. Let's say the Tara and the kvura, Tara is more of a minig, But you know, say everything from the ptira to the kvura that's involved to the actual physical act of burying the mace, which is very much a theme of this past week's parsha. Both are topics of the theme of this past week's parsha, both marriage and kvura, both just like our sugya, they both came together in Parshas Vayetzar. So you could say, all right, that mitzvah per se is addressed by having a chevra kedisha. If you have the same chevra kedisha, so then you can guarantee that all of this will be taken care of. It's interesting, in America it's different than in Israel. In America you don't really find the chevra kedisha playing the same role. The chevra kedisha in America is more focused on the tara and everything in the preparatory stage. The actual kvura, generally, as far as in our experience, is not really done by the chevra kedisha, it's done by the union. To a certain extent, and the Jews who are involved are usually people who are attending the funeral because they know the person, and then they get involved in the actual burial process. But in Eretz Yisrael, so they have all the levayas in Yerushalayim, so there the chevra kedisha is the standing chevra kedisha. There is actually doing the kvura itself, which is a little bit different than the American practice. So you could say, all right, if that's the whole din, if the whole fact is that we have to make sure that this individual is buried, so then you could say that, fine, that's the nature of the obligation. But we assume that the chiyuv of a levaya is much more than that. The chiyuv of a levaya is not only to make sure that the kvura happens. The chiyuv of a levaya is that is an expression of kavod itself that takes place at the time of burial, and it's really kind of independent. It's a parallel track, but that's not the kvura. It could happen without kesvedim, without people coming. You don't necessarily have to have that in order to have the kvura. So one gets the impression, it seems to be the case, that you have a whole other obligation here which is taking place at the same time. So it's hard to see how the chevra kedisha really fills that role. The chevra kedisha is not there to provide kavod in the sense of hespedim, in the sense of attendance to the mace. They're really focused on the burial itself. So how we get off the hook by having the chevra kedisha for that mitzvah is a little bit questionable and probably isn't the whole story. So what seems to emerge is that there is a chiyuv of kavod that is probably the common element here. So when the Gemara is telling us about this Mevatlan Talmud Torah component and telling us the two together, so it's telling us that there is a chiyuv kavod for both, and that expresses itself through Bittul Torah and Bittul Melacha, as the Shulchan Aruch adds on, right? That not just the Talmud Chacham, we don't just say Ein Ben Charon El Misha Osik Torah, but also if you can close your store and stop doing business that day. So then that's also a part of the mitzvah. A lot of practicalities about that we'll have to figure out. We'll have to talk about that a little bit tomorrow. But our Gemara is essentially making two points. Right? So our Gemara is grouping and comparing Chasen and Kala and Havayas and Meis, saying that they share a din. And at the same time, it's also making a different point. Right? What point is that same passage making? They're alike, and they're not alike, right? What, how are they not alike? That our Gemara says we give priority to the Kala. So it's also a way of saying that there is, to whatever extent there's a chiyuv for the mace, there's more of a chiyuv, you have to choose between the two, there's more of a chiyuv for the Kala. So what exactly does that suggest? And what does it tell us about the whole mitzvah? So I'll leave you with a question, which we'll pick up with tomorrow. And I'll ask you maybe tomorrow to add a few makaras also. So give this question some thought. So if there is a chiyuv kavod for the kala, let's say for the chasen and the kala, so is that an independent concept? Or is that a part of the mitzvah of simchas chasen and kala? It makes people happy when you respect them, when you show them honor, so it makes them happy. So maybe this is just a detail in Simchas Chasen Kala we're talking about, or is there an independent chiyuv in kavod? That may be a machlokas rishonim, and God willing, tomorrow We will discuss that a little more. We'll finish this up and we'll move on to other sugyas. So just quickly, what did we speak about today? So we talked about figuring out the nature of the Chiyuv Kala, what exactly would that mean, if it's different from Simchas Chasan Kala. We talked about the question, Rashi's statement that she's accompanied from her household, and the Drisha's question about, do we really do that nowadays, and the Taz's defense of our current practice, and the Shua and others talking about the variable factors that we have, or most is true about Sphere, the Chazon Ish's comments about the Minhagim that shift, Shlomo Zalman's comments about the variabilities within individuals. We talked about the issue of Dei Ma'asara, how that addresses emotional, personalized needs, and how that may fit in here. And other than that, a principle of reciprocity, and the Gemara and Sukkah saying about a Kodesh Baruch who has the same attitude. And we talked parenthetically about the concern of the Kingdom of Tira, if you have a negative reciprocity mentality, how exactly does that play in? Then we talked about what is the key of being the Sameach Chasam Akala. Is it simply being there, or is there something more to it, as it seems to suggest, which has nothing to mean as for how to properly fulfill this mitzvah, how to avoid a criticism of Nana Mitzvah's Chasin Nana Masamcho, and also could play a nafkamina for Shabbat Brachos if you want to be considered a Parm Chadashos at a later Shabbat Brachos and you stopped into the wedding. To what extent is that going to be affected by that question? We talked about what does the emphasis on Merakt and Margamara mean, and the fact that it shifts from there to something of Amira. Is that a way of dancing? Is it Merakdim really just kind of a code word for Simcha in general and not really be about dancing? Does the word mean Merakdim mean to make other people dance as opposed to Ropdim? So we discussed all that possibility. We talked about the question of what does it mean to give our Torah? What's the role of Simcha in Torah? And what does the Gemara mean when it says Agra de Behilula Milei? What is the Milei about? And what does the word Behilula mean? And the Radak's idea of Mahal and Bo Sakala, and how that plays a role here. We talked about the Chavos Yaris Tshuva, about Talmud Chacham should feel comfortable being involved in the dancing as well. We talked about how Gemara has some rather extreme examples of that. And then we talked about this comparison Gemara makes about Mavatlin for Hatzos Ames and for Achnas Eskala. We talked about the Machlok's Rishonim of whether this is a Rishus or a Mitzvah, how most of the Rishonim actually say it's a Chiyuv, it's not a Rishus, and then we tried to figure out how that accords to, we started to talk about how that accords with the Minute. We talked about whether the Chevra Kedisha is an adequate resolution as far as Havayas Ames is concerned, and then the question of our Gemara not only puts the two in the same category that distinguishes between the two and says that the Kala gets priority. It seems to be that there's a Chiyuv of Kava that applies to both and even more to a Kala. So then we left with the question of, we're going to have to try to figure out, is this Chiyuv Kava for a Kala an extension of the idea of Simchas Chasam and Kala, that's a part of what makes people happy, or is it an independent Chiyuv? And God willing, we'll see a little bit more about that tomorrow. All right, who wants to daven for us? Do you want to daven for us? Okay, Ashrei.